Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, a local physician and your host for an hour of medical news, debate, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, and also answers to your calls and emails. All that and more in the next hour here on Ask Dr. Dawn. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. I want to talk a little bit about a very interesting study that was published in Nature this week. It was written up in the New York Times, and that's where I heard about it from one of my loyal listeners who sends me interesting things. A big shout out there to Duff. Thank you. And this is research in Nature by Pierre Bork of the European Molecular Biology Laboratory in Heidelberg. Well, you've certainly heard me talk about bowel flora and the importance of the intestinal microbiome and how antibiotics can mess that up. And just recently, we were talking about molecular mimicry in reference to the immune system and how, for example, people with Klebsiella who have a certain kind of HLA antigen, that's a barcode on the surface of their cells that is how we do our tissue matching for organ transplants. Well, people with HLA-B27 who have a bacteria in their intestine called Klebsiella will often develop a reactive arthritis. And this is a review, right? You've heard this recently. People with Pseudomonas in their intestine, there's an association with Pseudomonas and possibly multiple sclerosis, although that's very much in the research phase, not established as a cause, and I want to emphasize that. So with all of this talk about what's growing in your intestines, you might think that the intestines would be, well, just all sorts of complicated differences. But in fact, what Dr. Bork's research suggests is that there are, he's calling them enterotypes, similar to blood types. And they have been researching different individuals, and their N is, well, they have about, at this point, a couple hundred people whose microbiomes have been, let's say, characterized in detail. The exciting thing about this research is that those 400 people tend to cluster into three distinct categories. And it's as if there was, in fact, a ecology inside. I use the phrase internal ecology a lot, but in fact, this is a study that suggests that that is exactly what's going on. So everyone kind of clusters, at least these research subjects, into three separate categories, three separate ecosystems. So to put that out in a way that you might understand it, in this area, we have the coastal redwood forest, and that's a ecosystem. It has a certain characteristic, certain plants, certain animals, certain things grow or don't grow. Another ecosystem that's around locally is the chaparral, completely different, much drier. And again, different plants, different birds, different animals in the chaparral. Well, imagine that you had desert, pine forest, and jungle, and those are the ecosystems. They're all very distinctly different. And yeah, one desert versus another desert, there are going to be differences, but the overall similarity in terms of what you're going to find in a desert, cactus and euphorbia and snakes and lots of insects, versus what you're going to find in a pine forest, which would be birds and lots of little rodential things going around eating the nuts, and what you're going to find in a jungle, which of course has enormous biodiversity, but we know what we're going to get. So if, in fact, this research replicates, what it means is that your intestinal ecology is established very young and follows you throughout life. And there may be certain disease states or disease tendencies, like I've suggested earlier, that are collaterally more or less likely depending upon the microbiome. So if we start thinking in terms of disease and thinking in terms of how the human body works as being this ecology, it's going to change our perspective and our approach, and it's going to make us be different in our medical approach, perhaps a little bit more ecologic, thinking in terms of inputs. I thought it was fascinating, and I wanted to share it with you. Before we go to our first caller, and I'm going to let her on early because she is holding all the way from Buffalo, New York, let me remind you that you can always listen to this program by going to askdrdawn.com And you can subscribe to the podcast, which I would encourage you to do. And also hit the buttons while you're there and follow me on Facebook or Twitter if you are in the social media world. And we shall go now to our first caller, who is Andrea from Buffalo, New York.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello, Andrea. Welcome to the program.
Oh, finally. I've been listening to your podcast for about 5 years now.
Cool.
And I never can jive the time to call you, but
you've got it.
Yeah. All right. About 4 or 5 years ago, I was diagnosed with lichen planus skin disease. Have
yes.
you heard of it?
Oh, yes. Yes.
It was after a biopsy of, you know, these strange little sores. Now, I looked it up on the internet, and the doctor told me there was really no treatment except steroid ointments, which I've been using, various different ones. And it's mainly been confined to my legs, but now I've noticed it's spreading more, like getting more on the other leg, some on my chest, a few on my arm. And I wonder if there's anything other than these steroid, basically different steroid creams. She's given me Elidil. I can't remember all the names. Betamethasone and something.
Well, Elidil is actually not a steroid cream. It's a immune suppressant of a different stripe.
Okay. It's used for eczema. That's what I was...
Right, exactly. But there are indeed steroids that are also used for this. So let's talk a little bit about lichen planus. These look like lichen on a rock, hence the name. They're flat. Mm-hmm. They are scaly and kind of red and irritated, and they are a subset of eczema, effectively. Again, uh-huh. Mysterious. Now, I'm about to tell you a dermatology joke, because doctors are always poking fun at each other, and the surgeons, I forget what the internal medicine people call surgeons, but I know that the surgeons call internal medicine doctors fleas, you know, and there's a joke about that. What's the last thing to leave a dying dog, you know, and they're all really nasty jokes. And so the one we tell about the dermatologists is that you can sum up dermatology in one phrase, which goes, if it's wet, you dry it. If it's dry, you wet it. And you always add steroids. That's really kind of insulting. And the dermatologists were really happy when they got these other drugs like Elidil because it wasn't a steroid. So it made the aphorism untrue. But it's a strong immune suppressant and they are given for eczema. When they were first introduced, we were very happy because we thought, oh my goodness, now we can treat the kids with eczema and not have to give them steroids, which might stunt their growth or thin their skin. But it turns out that some of the kids who got Elidil got this weird lymphoma of their skin. And it's like, oh, we're really over-suppressing the immune system, aren't we? And this was a rare disease and it's a rare side effect, but nevertheless, creepy enough that there was a kind of massive let's back away from using this widely. It's still used in adults where it's probably less dangerous. But what does this say? That we are suppressing the immune system. So what's activating the immune system? And you'll remember, if you're a regular podcast listener, you will have heard me introduce this concept of molecular mimicry recently, where you're being exposed to something, perhaps as an infection, and your immune system is saying, okay, we've got to make antibodies against this intruder. But then the intruder alert cross-reacts with something on your body, something in your skin, perhaps, and you end up with a lichen planus or an eczema. And another way this can happen is something called immune complex disease, where your immune system is actually grabbing antigens that do exist in your system, and it's doing what it's supposed to do, which is grab these antigens and activate the immune system to dispose of them. But in doing that, it's also creating a rash or creating swollen lymph nodes or arthralgias, which are joint pain. So what are you going to do? I have a couple of suggestions for you, and they're very alternative. So I'll start by saying that these are alternative suggestions. This is not straight medicine. One thing I would do is look for food sensitivities, either with blood testing or by going on an elimination diet. And the other thing I would do is go on a hunt for chronic infections.
Okay, well, I am taking furosemide, which I looked at as one of the drug-induced lichen planus reasons. At least on the internet.
Okay, well, then there you go. Then you've got drug side effect as another possibility. Does the timing work, though? You've been on the...
No, the timing doesn't. Possibly, because if I were to stop taking the furosemide, would the lichen planus go away? Really, what I'm wondering.
Yeah, but the trouble is it might take a long time to do that, and you might need the furosemide for other reasons. So what I meant by does the timing work was, did you start having the lichen planus after you were taking the furosemide?
Yes.
Okay. So it's at least a viable hypothesis. What mm-hmm. you could do would be to go to your doctor and get a different loop diuretic. And there are several loop diuretics that are less commonly used. Torsemide, and I don't know if that one has the lichen planus connection as well, but you could certainly research that and see if that's been reported. Try to get on.
Well, it was. Yes, it was. But the hydrochlorothiazide has the sulfa. There's more of an allergic reaction from that.
Right. So if you're not sulfa allergic and your doctor says that it's okay for you to make the switch, then it would be reasonable to make the switch and look for new lesions and anticipate that if it is a drug effect, given the nature, the slow nature of skin, you're probably needing to be off of it for a couple of months before you'll be able to make the call.
About a month? A
couple of months, I'd say.
Yeah. And is it plausible that the lesions may heal?
Yes.
And not
it's plausible that
after?
The lesions might heal after an appropriate period off the drug. And I'm pulling the 2 months out of my hat because the skin renews itself every month or so. So in most of the areas you're discussing, if you give it 2 months, you'll have gone through two regenerative cycles. And at that point, if the lesions haven't resolved, then I don't think it's the drugs. And then you can do the other things I mentioned, which are get a high sensitivity C-reactive protein, looking for evidence of inflammation. If you see it.
Okay, I did have that. Mm-hmm. I had that in my regular blood.
And is it elevated?
It was a 1. Was not a 0.5, but I was 1.
Okay.
It's pretty low.
It's low.
Under, 1
yeah.
or under is okay.
1 or under is okay, so it suggests that you don't have sinus infection or tooth infection as the source for the bacteria. It probably doesn't work for intestinal dysbiosis, but I would also definitely do an elimination diet if you're eliminating the Lasix doesn't mm-hmm. take care of the problem. But you're doing good. You're doing the research and you're thinking. So congratulations.
In terms of the bacterial infection, that's concerning me. What could there be some sort of systemic bacteria thing causing it?
Systemic as in the intestine, yes. That would be where I would go looking in a person
really?
With a sed rate of 1.
So probiotics would help with that. I do use them.
Well, you might need more than just probiotics. You might need to kind of reboot the intestinal flora. It's a bit complicated. If you go and look at the Ask Dr. Don website and look at mm-hmm. topics going back, you will find discussions of how to reboot your flora, but it generally involves the use of either natural microbiocidal compounds or using actual antibiotics and then reforesting or replenishing the probiotics after you've cleaned up all the bad actors.
Mm. Okay.
So it's a bit more complicated than I want to get into right now.
No, I understand that. Is there any oral medication, probably not, that would help the lichen planus? I'm going to the dermatologist this week, and you know, I have one very big lesion. I don't know if it, in fact, is lichen planus.
Yeah, but, the only thing I would say is make sure your vitamin D levels are high, like 45 or 50, and then oral vitamin D might be helpful here.
Yeah, I've been taking 2,000 a day.
Check your levels.
Vitamin D.
Check your levels.
Test my level.
Check your levels. 25/OH vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Okay.
Thank you,
right.
Andrea. Thank you for calling
much.
All the way from Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo. I've been wanting to call you for years, and it was really a treat. I had to work this out because we're, you know, the timing. We're
exactly.
12 o'clock Buffalo time.
Well, thank you
thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Well, that was nice and fit nicely with this concept that I started off the show with of the human enterocyte microbiome. Maybe we have enterotypes as well as blood types. Wouldn't that be interesting? You know, back before they discovered blood types, it was really funny how sometimes you gave a blood transfusion to someone and they did great. They perked up, they were fine. And then sometimes you gave a blood transfusion to someone and they grabbed their neck, went, ah, and died. What was going on? Well, guess what? Something was going on, rather important. Let's take an email. This one from Khalid in Saudi Arabia. Hello, Dr. Don, and thank you for the wonderful program. My question is about vitamin supplements. My wife and I have 5 kids, the youngest being 2, and the oldest is 8. We are both 35 and do not have any health complications, but we do not always eat what you would call a healthy, well-balanced diet. My question is, would it be a good idea to start taking multivitamin supplements, and do you recommend any vitamins to the kids? If yes, do you have any brands that you can recommend? Well, Khalid, in your case, I'm going to make an exception because I can't exactly tell you to pop down to the local health food store. So I will give you some specific companies that I do feel produce very good vitamins and would be available online, and so you can probably get them shipped. First of all, I think that if one is not eating a healthy, well-balanced diet with lots of fruits and vegetables, that it is very, very important to take a multivitamin. Trace minerals are very variable all over the world, and yet we know that the trace minerals necessary for optimum metabolism are not always going to be obtained from food. So that being said, a multivitamin that contains trace amounts of selenium and iodine and the various other trace minerals is important. Also, in this very stressful world, and I think I would say that 5 kids would qualify you, probably a B vitamin supplement like a B50 or a B100 would be a great idea for both you and your wife. Third, some kind of omega-3 fatty acid, because the blend of oil in the modern diet, particularly if you eat packaged foods of any kind, is not optimal for our biology. And so we want to increase the amount of omega-3 fatty acids, and that's fish. Again, maybe not something that you can get so healthy or fresh where you are. And use of fish oil, so cod liver oil with extra omega-3s, fish oil. And there's a great fish oil for children. It comes in these lovely little tangerine gummy things that are delicious and hard not to overdose on even as an adult. And they're made by a company called Nordic Naturals. And they also make a good children's vitamin. And they have a good online service, so I'm pretty sure you'll be able to obtain those even as far away as you are. For adult multivitamins, there is a company called Metagenics, Metagenics. They make a very good multi, and they make one that's adapted for women, one that's adapted for men. And if you are over 50, I recommend getting multivitamins without the iron. If you're under 50, then the iron is probably not such a bad idea, particularly if a woman is menstruating. I think extra iron is a real good idea. So hopefully that will give you some useful information. I want to go to another email now, and this one is Kim in Santa Cruz. Kim says, I was recently referred to a gastroenterologist for a recurring but infrequent cough that my primary doctor thought might either be allergies or the result of acid reflux. I wasn't sure I've actually had it except on occasion. I have an endoscopy scheduled for May, but in the meantime, I think I might have developed an additional symptom. It feels like something is stuck in my throat. I feel more worried now that there could be a serious problem. Of course, now Kim is worried about esophageal cancer. What other things besides esophageal cancer could cause this, and how worried should I be? Kim is 47 and in good health. So probably, Kim, what you have is esophageal irritation and swelling. The sense of something stuck in the throat can also be strongly related to stress. And once you start worrying about something stuck in your throat, that symptom is going to get worse all by itself. When I worry about esophageal cancer is when people tell me that they're having trouble eating. So they start losing weight. They can't swallow, say, dry crackers or something like that because it tends to get stuck in their throat. They might even start choking and have to cough food up because they can't get it down if they eat it rapidly. That's the sort of symptom that makes me think about a stricture or some sort of actual physical obstruction in the esophagus. People who just have that sensation but are still able to swallow solids, particularly dry solids, don't worry me very much at all. In the short run, over-the-counter proton pump inhibitors for up to 2 weeks, and in the natural world, 2 compounds, deglycerized licorice and marshmallow, and those latter two are demulcents in the old herbal terms, and that means that they are coating, soothing coatings that will protect the esophagus against acid and soothe any irritation that could be triggering the nerves and giving you that foreign body sensation. So I hope you find this helpful. I'm glad you have an endoscopy scheduled. But in the short run, you might want to, as I said, do the proton pump inhibitors and these natural demulcent agents and see if you can alleviate some of your discomfort. So we had some interesting things in the healthcare politics this week, and I thought I would just throw out a couple of these First of all, one thing that Congress actually managed to agree upon was repealing something called the 1099 requirements. And this was a very unpopular thing because it required businesses to report anything more than $600 a year of vendor purchases to the IRS. How that's supposed to help healthcare reform, I have no idea, but somehow it made it into the legislation. And if anyone who's running a small business, even a very small business, would realize that $600 from any single vendor, you know, more paperwork, maybe lots of 1099s that you're going to have to fill out for your, you know, little side business where you're selling whatever. Other things that happened this week is that the Senate is very much in opposition of the board that was created by the new legislation. And this board was going to empower over Medicare. It was charged with creating savings in Medicare and reining in Medicare costs. Now, this took power, as the senators saw it, away from the Senate. And both the Republicans, and I'm referring to John Cornyn, who's a Republican from Texas, introduced a bill last month to repeal this, saying that it punts the difficult decisions on health spending to an unelected, unaccountable board of bureaucrats. You mean somebody that doesn't need to get a whole bunch of money from big pharma and big business might be making decisions that would affect corporate bottom line profits? And you oppose that, Senator? Well, am I surprised? And we have a Democrat saying, it's our constitutional duty as members of Congress to take responsibility for Medicare and not to turn decisions over to a board. Abdicating this responsibility undermines our ability to represent our constituents, including seniors and the disabled, also including big pharma and large entities which do not necessarily represent the interests of the seniors and the disabled. Wise up, folks. Congress has brilliantly demonstrated that they cannot agree on anything. They cannot deal with a crisis, even a huge crisis that's life-threatening for the very existence of our country. These people cannot sit down and agree. They're busy grandstanding on Fox and collecting large contributions from major donors, which now, in the wake of that Supreme Court decision, are unlimited. What type of crazy is this? Anyway, my point is, we need an independent board. We need people who don't have to get reelected, who can actually maybe not be bribable, who might conceivably be able to make difficult decisions and do things like say to Big Pharma, you know, we're going to force you to give us the same discount on drugs that you give the Canadians. How about that? How about those apples? We actually paid for the development of these drugs, and now you're sticking it to us big time to pay for them because, excuse me, why is that okay? Well, it's okay because it would interfere with the free market, I guess. I'm sorry, but the fix is in here in our government. We need an independent board if we're ever going to cut costs. The Congress can't do it. The Senate can't do it. They're immired in their own reelection cycle and can no longer effectively govern, and they can no longer make difficult decisions. And speaking of that, private Medicare plans just got a reprieve from cuts. So all those Medicare Advantage plans that were going to get a cut, well, and this was the Obama side, reinstituted awards of quality bonuses, even to Medicare Advantage's plans that only scored average on quality. This is another $6.7 billion infusion to the Medicare Advantage plans. Why? Well, guess what? Seniors like their Medicare Advantage plans, and seniors vote. So Obama would like to get reelected, and hence we're going to put more money into those plans, even though they are an extra cost, and this is an era where we should be cost-cutting. But not when it's going to affect your reelection chances. Like I said, we need independent oversight here. The political system cannot do this, and they are demonstrating it beautifully. And let's go to our next caller, and this is Teresa from Ashland, Oregon. Hello, Teresa, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don, and I am so glad that you get all fired up about these political subjects. Hear, hear, I say.
Well, thank you.
Okay. And I'm calling to talk about the lichen planus wart that you spoke with a previous caller.
Go ahead.
And we have discussed before things on the radio. One was the fact that I could never get my vitamin D levels up, no matter how much I supplemented. And you suggested that it was an inflammatory condition, which indeed it turned out to be. And then we discussed celiac disease. And so I did want to let that person who called in say that I have lichen planus warts on my legs. And, of course, the dermatologist wanted to do their typical treatment, which fortunately I didn't go with. But and all of the physicians I've seen over the last 15 to 20 years who have been trying to treat me have taken my C-reactive protein, and of course it was normal. But what I have found out is that a complement called complement 4A seems to be high in people with celiac disease, and so is eosinophil cationic protein. But of course that person might just want to test to see if they have a wheat problem, and you are always so right about these things.
Well, thank you very much for that. Obviously, I'm not, because I didn't think to tell her about those, and I didn't actually know that complement C4A was a marker.
Complement C4A, yes, and there are many doctors that you probably have met them in your functional medicine symposiums that you go to, such as Dr. Richie Shoemaker, that tracks the C4A and relates it to mold toxicity. So for years, I was waylaid on that line until, with further research, you can find out that that high C4A and that high eosinophil cationic protein will both point towards the celiac problem.
Okay, well,
and so,
good. Good.
Yeah. Okay, and that's my input.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and I will go and review those. By the way, for those of you who are interested in reviewing the medical literature, Google Scholar is an excellent way of doing an and search. So you put both terms in, and it's very good at finding things. I use it all the time when I'm researching a particular nutrient and a particular chemotherapy compound, for example, because I'd like to check those before I tell people it's all right to use something. So thank you again, Teresa.
Yes, and I use Google Scholar all the time. It seems that you bring the articles in from Google Scholar. They're the ones that your physician are more apt to accept, even though many physicians do not want to hear from their patients at all. You are not one of those. So
right. But
Thank you. But
like I said, no good deed goes unpunished on that one, because it definitely costs you time, and time is money. And listening to your patients is a moral imperative to be a good physician. But we have an economic structure, and you're always going to hear me, you know, soapbox on this one. We have an economic structure that punishes you for being a good physician.
Exactly, for spending more than 15 minutes, which I hear that you do with your patients.
I tend to get a lot of flack from the people who are sitting behind the person I spent the extra time with. But that's life. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Mardine in Ben Lomond. Hello, Mardine, and welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you very much. So refreshing and wonderful to hear anybody in the health profession talk about insurance the way you do. I wish that that the doctors could control the situation more and give their patients what they really need, which is affordable health care. I had to give up my health insurance a couple of years ago because of the economic situation, and was not able to even get insurance for a while because I have a heart murmur, which was considered a pre-existing condition by most medical coverage. And I recently got a job where there are benefits available, but to insure my family would cost me a quarter of my income.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't do it. So my solution so far is to get supplemental health insurance, all the Aflac or, you know, Marsh programs that are available that I can get. My company offers a flexible spending program, which is pre-tax dollars that can be used from a bank account for health coverage, for health expenses. So I'm putting some money away in that and, getting accident insurance. And I don't know yet whether I can get cancer coverage in the event of cancer, you know, without having major medical in place. But I just wondered if you have any suggestions of ways to do that, to kind of go around the system and, you know, not have the major medical coverage with the giant high deductibles, but something with, you know, that will cover the really awful situations where you get in a car accident or you get a heart attack or, you know, something like that.
Okay, so every person who is in this circumstance has to educate themselves about what's out there and also take a good look at what their risks are. So, for example, a young man I know, I was giving advice to his fiance a couple of weeks ago, and he is a race car driver, which means at the age of 28, although he is stunningly healthy, he can't get health insurance because, of course, he might get into major trauma and he would be a bad risk for a health plan. So once they find out what his profession is, he's pretty much unable to get health insurance. What he can get is long-term care insurance, which doesn't scan for profession and looks at your age. And, you know, 28-year-old buying long-term care insurance is in a good situation in the market, because normally it's 55-year-olds who've just discovered that their mother has Alzheimer's, and they're the people who are buying insurance because they need it, because they might actually use it, which is, of course, adversarial in our current setting. So you have to get smart and look at all of the available things out there and what are your risks and how much can you protect. If you're healthy, then you're going to pay for your pap smears and your mammograms and your various other health maintenance things. Make sure your children get immunized, and the Healthy Families programs are available for many middle-income families that would not qualify for anything else can qualify for Healthy Families. So you,
I had a hard time qualifying for that as well.
Okay. But did you? For your kids?
I tried, and I was also trying to get Medicare at that time, and was rejected for Medicare. And after spending 2 hours interviewing and going through all the paperwork, I just gave up.
Don't give up. And by the way, the government makes that hoop impossibly high. They don't facilitate it. In California, there's also a plan, a very good plan for people with pre-existing conditions that's supported, but you have to have two criteria. One, you have to go bare for 6 months. And two, you have to have been rejected by all of the major plans, rejected on, you know, your uninsurable grounds based
on
pre-existing. So if you can meet those criteria and you've gone bare, that doesn't mean that you don't have cancer insurance and you don't have these other things. It means that you don't have health insurance and you can prove that you are uninsurable.
Yeah.
And then after 6 months, you can actually qualify. And the state-funded plan, which is subsidized, has a reasonable premium.
What's that called? How do you find it?
You send me an email at askdrdon.com and I'll send you the link. The link is actually on my website if you go to the resources page.
Okay.
And if you can't find it, then go to the message us, contact us feature on that website and contact us and we'll take care of that.
Okay, great.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're the only country that is industrialized and prosperous on the planet where that conversation could have happened. Okay. Not even South Africa anymore. We're it. We're the only people crazy enough to be putting our population through this. All right, stepping off the soapbox and going on now to Bob in Watsonville. Hello, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Dawn. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thanks for waiting.
You bet. So about a year and a half ago, I had been diagnosed with atrial fibrillation, and then it was later changed to atrial flutter diagnosis. I underwent a catheter ablation last July, and in January, it was deemed a full success. And I was taken off the Coumadin and beta blocker and so forth. And the electrocardiologist told me that I should be taking full-strength aspirin, one a day, for the rest of my life. And so, you know, I started to do that, and eventually in March, I went to an Ayurvedic and a nutritionalist combination, and they said, well, we're going to really help you change your diet and get you off this aspirin, and we'll be doing you a lot better good than the aspirin itself. So I actually stopped taking the aspirin, but I wanted to get your opinion on that whole situation.
I think that if you had a successful ablation, and how old are you?
Just about 60.
Okay, so 60-year-old male, you have the atrial fibrillation / fib flutter. It's been cured. We'll use that term, actually cured by a surgical procedure which removed the bypass tract. So now you are in sinus rhythm and very likely to stay that way. Under those circumstances, a baby aspirin reduces your risk of having a heart attack or a stroke sufficiently in the statistical world that would be the recommendation. This is straight standard medicine based on the herd eating a standard American diet. Now, to the extent that you are not in the herd because you are eating a diet high in anti-inflammatories, lots of maybe turmeric and lots of omega-3 fatty acids and flaxseed oil and things like that. So you're eating a diet that is in itself anticoagulant. And so you probably don't need the aspirin because you're not eating the procoagulant diet. But we won't be able to prove that in a large statistical group because we don't have enough people like you, or the budget, more accurately, we don't have the budget to aggregate everybody like you and study them such that we could establish that it's as good head-to-head as taking a baby aspirin. People who have atrial fibrillation who might go into it again and not notice it might be advised by a cardiologist to take a full aspirin with the idea that at least you're reducing the chances that they're going to go back into fibrillation, not notice it, and develop a clot, right, and then have that clot flip off and go to the brain and give them a stroke. I have noticed that cardiologists will do everything they can to follow the standard rules because they would really like to be protected in a lawsuit against an accusation of neglect. And a smart lawyer can basically make you look bad for anything, right? We all know that. And a smart lawyer could say, well, that you, Mr. Cardiologist, did not tell this person to take an aspirin, even though you knew there was a possibility they could go back into atrial fibrillation, so you are responsible for this stroke. You know, we'd like $50 million, please. Thank you very much. And so I think you're seeing perhaps a little defensive medicine, and I'm not faulting the doctor for doing it because I'm faulting the legal system for allowing such lawsuits to ever occur. And they're rare, but when they do occur, they have a profound effect on the sociology of medicine for decades. And that's the thing. There's an amplification of the effect of our medical malpractice climate. One bad case changes everybody's behavior for, like I said, literally decades.
Yep. And the thing that they mentioned was there is the possibility, apparently the possibility of recurrence, although in my research I've found that it's fairly low.
Yes.
And so I'm thinking that that's, as you said, that's probably part of the reason for the aspirin.
Allow me to empower you, okay? I'm going to give you permission to ignore your doctor's advice. People ignore their doctor's advice all the time. If you look at like statin prescriptions, for example, or blood pressure medicine prescriptions, and the person gets a prescription from the doctor, and they fill the first one, and they fill the second one, the rate of fall off by the time you get out to 6 months is about 50% of people have stopped taking their meds, either because of side effects or because of cost or because they think that, well, I took it for a while and I got better, so now I no longer need it. People blow us off all the time. So I'm going to give you permission to be one of the great horde of people who ignores medical advice.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn.
Well, ergo te absolve, okay?
Thanks so much.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And let's talk to David in Salinas. Hello, David, and welcome to the program.
Yes, Dr. Dawn. Thanks again for your show. My brother in Bangkok, Thailand, at present, has stage 4 melanoma in his lungs. And he has in the past, from a non-specific melanoma.
Right.
And he has in the past spent about $20,000 or $30,000 on immunotherapy, which put it off for a few years. And now he's just going to rough it out. He's working on his diet, and he's taking his family, he's buying a sailboat, he's going to rough it out, and that's his plan right now.
Okay, so what's your
question? And I don't know what can you offer in that regard.
I'm not sure what you mean by your question. If a person has stage 4 melanoma, immunotherapy can prolong their life, and it sounds like it bought him some time. There have even been rare cases of apparent clinical full remission, but again, those are rare. And what triggers those beyond some very fortuitous combination of circumstances, no one can say. The thing to remember, and the first message I would give to your brother is, after expressing sorrow and compassion for him, I would say that in a way, since we all die, and some of us die after a long period of dwindling away with loss of our minds and loss of our dignity, and some of us die at absurdly young ages in tragic accidents, that the death of a fully realized adult individual with a family, surrounded by people who love you, with your brain cells intact, is not necessarily the worst of all possible deaths, and that he should be sure that when he starts to become ill and weak, that he's in a setting where there is hospice available, where he has the availability of pain medications, that he can basically go to sleep and not wake up. And that is the best death that we can sometimes offer people. And it depends on his level of pain, whether he needs to take that exit route or not. But if he's sailing around the world, you want to have a way to be near a country where there is a hospice system in place, or have a relationship with a sympathetic physician in a country where that physician can give you massive doses of these agents without getting his license pulled. Mexico is a very good place for that. They have some very good clinics for cancer, even for people who are just looking for palliative care. And in the United States, there is a highly developed hospice system on the West Coast and in other isolated areas of the United States as well. So that would be my advice to him.
Well, that's pretty much his plan, Dr. Don. That's exactly what he's doing. He's got a fully realized life, and he's going to enjoy it as long as he can. And I just wanted some support in that idea.
I think he's being eminently sensible. Thank you for the call.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Don.
Bye-bye. We're going now to Lori in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lori, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Let's see. I have rheumatoid arthritis and Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And my RA has been really, really well controlled over the last 10 years. Just, kind of went through a real radical change of diet at the beginning, especially eliminating fats and taking tons of fish oil. I know you recommend that sort of thing. And I'm having a flare now. And a friend of mine who has lupus was telling me that she had some great results from, practicing an elimination diet and just kind of getting off of everything. And I don't want to do that again.
Okay, you don't want to do it again. But, so what are the foods that you really crave? There's a little diagnostic test here.
So
what are the things you really crave?
Yeah, I really, the sugar is kind of a thing, but as long as I am not feeding it, then I don't crave it as much,
Yeah. All right. So it's mainly...
And wheat.
Sugar and wheat. Okay.
Yeah. And coffee. I don't know how I can give up coffee.
I actually don't think you have to give up coffee. Coffee is the least of your worries.
Okay, great.
Okay. So first thing to try in rheumatoid arthritis flares, a certain subset of individuals really react to the nightshade vegetables. So that's your tomatoes, peppers, eggplant kind of things. And look up nightshade vegetables. Take everything off. You can eliminate those. Those are not on the, oh my God, I can't live without them list.
Yeah, I've done that before.
And see if that helps.
Because
it might be enough with your flare, and that's probably a molecular mimicry issue. So give that a shot.
Okay.
Secondly, as far as the wheat is concerned, if you crave it, then you probably have antibodies to it. You probably do have IgG against it. And we know that if you have immune complexes, which is, in other words, you eat the wheat, the IgG grabs it. Those immune complexes do filter out into the joints. They filter out into the capillary beds of the skin and the gut and the joints. So it really may be fueling your flare.
Okay.
And so I, tough love here.
Yeah.
Off of anything with gluten, if you...
Okay, so that's like also like rye and, I mean, there's...
Read the list, and you can only eat gluten-certified free oats because you really want to eliminate those antigens.
Okay.
The other thing is, back to the molecular mimicry concept again, people who have had a course of antibiotics or people who have had a gastroenteritis that happened before they started their flare, if there's any kind of change in the gut function or there was an illness in the intestines before the flare started, then probiotics, and maybe think about a gut cleanup program, taking some microbiocidal oils like oregano oil. And I mean, there's, I'm not going to try to get into a full bone functional medicine thing here with you. You can call me at the office and come in and we'll do the whole thing, or you can go online and research it and goodness knows there's a huge popular literature about this.
The leaky gut thing?
The whole dysbiosis thing. So search dysbiosis, go read those sites, DYS, and you'll find a lot of information.
Okay.
Chase the flare.
Okay.
What changed? Were there more stressors? Was there an illness? Look back at when the flare started, like the month or two leading up to it,
yeah.
and look for clues. Or you could do everything and do a shotgun approach. But if you are a little bit more strategic about it, maybe you can have your cake and eat it too, so to speak, but it'll be rice cake.
Okay. You know, I did give up my dog. Maybe there's a little emotional something or other.
Well, yeah. I can't imagine giving up my doggie.
Oh.
That would be terrible.
I know. I was supposed to just be dog sitting for 6 months, but I got totally attached. And gosh.
Well, okay, so you need a new dog.
Yeah.
Preferably one that looks like that one.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Let me take a moment to ping on what last caller said, which was about her food cravings. And when she feeds her sugar and starch, she finds that if she doesn't eat them, then her cravings vanish or limit. And in fact, a study just published showed exactly that. If you put people on a diet and you put them on a low-carb diet, after a little while, their carbohydrate cravings disappear. And they also lose more weight. So if you put people on a high-fat diet, which means a lot of carbs, their carbohydrate cravings increase. So that's all insulin and totally understandable if you understand the hormones there. Let's go to Michael in Bellingham, Washington. Hello, Michael. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm recently became aware of your show while visiting Santa Cruz, and I'm a big fan of your show, and I have this little ritual now on Saturdays where I sit out on West Cliff Drive and listen to your show in my car viewing the ocean, and it's just a very warming, peaceful thing all along, but in many ways. So, again, thank you. My question involves, it kind of relates to one of the other calls today, arrhythmia in the heart. And
yes.
So I have a very extremely healthy lifestyle, plant-based diet, occasional wild fish, exercise daily. I'm a nature photographer. I usually hike almost every day, several miles, et cetera, et cetera.
So how old are you?
And I'm 54.
Okay, go ahead.
And what has happened, though, is that on occasion, I've noticed some mild arrhythmia in my heart where basically maybe like once every 8 to 10 beats or maybe a little bit lesser, you know, once every 20 to beats, I'll definitely notice an offset beat. And so doing my research online, then I've bumped up my fish oil a bit further and have taken hawthorn and berry for, you know, like maybe like 30 days or so. And each of those times I've done that, the symptom has gone totally away. And then it doesn't reappear for quite a long time, even if I drop back to what I was doing mm-hmm. earlier with no hawthorn berries. And so I just wondered if you had any other insights as to, you know, what else I could do.
Sure.
In a more preventative sense.
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, I wouldn't bop off of the omega-3s. I would stay on them. If you take at least 2,000 milligrams of EPA, it stabilizes the heart rhythm. And that's a good thing for a 54-year-old man. So stay on the fish oil. Number two would be manage your stress and make sure that you're not taking things that are cardiac irritants. And two common cardiac irritants are caffeine and the decongestant group of drugs. So if people are using decongestants, some of the Chinese herbs, in particular Chinese ephedra, which is mahuang, M-A-H-U-A-N-G, those can be cardiac stimulants. And some people may be getting that in an energy or a wellness formula, particularly a cognitive formula, will often have that. So think in terms of checking ingredients for things that might be cardiac stimulants. And, of course, your own adrenaline is a lovely cardiac stimulant. So are you flaring up when you're under stress? Do you need to be doing a little more meditation or backing off your workload such that you aren't facing deadline pressure quite so much? And if you see a connection between, for example, deadline pressure and these episodes, and I'm sure you can look back at your schedule and figure that out.
Yeah.
So there you have it, a couple of ideas about what might be feeding into it. Another suggestion for prevention is the amino acid taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E. And taurine stabilizes the heart rhythm. I've used it successfully in lots of patients with premature ventricular contractions. I do agree with your Hawthorne and your fish oil, but that's an additional thing that I think can help stabilize heart rhythms. And finally, PVCs, if that's indeed what they are not necessarily bad. When to worry is if there's an associated dizziness or a slight faint feeling or a little nausea and sweatiness when you're having these extra beats, and then I'm concerned. If the beats happen after exercise, then I'm concerned.
Yeah. So I'm noticing more of them more at rest, actually, in the evening than any time. But
that's when everybody notices them. That's when you notice everything more, itching more, everything. But the question is, the real red flag for me is if somebody has just taken a hike and they sit down at the top of the steep hill and they're having more of those extra beats. Because then I'm worried they're being generated by a little relative starvation of a part of the heart that's getting ischemic. And that means you've got a small blocked blood vessel, and that one you want to figure out.
Right. Just two quick follow-up questions on the taurine that you mentioned. So you're suggesting supplementation of that specifically or some kind of clustering of aminos together?
No, that one specifically.
All right. Great. That's very good. Thank you very much for your help. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, and thank you for the call. Please keep listening. And remember, if you do the Facebook or Twitter thing, I've gone to a great deal of effort to start putting stuff out there, so I'm hoping to build an audience for that.
Yeah, I think I'll definitely sign on to those.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Go to the website and hit the Twitter and Facebook buttons at AskDrDon.com. And I want to take one last moment to promote next week's show. We're going to be talking with an infectious disease doctor, Dr. David Wright, about the issue of tick-borne diseases and a little thing that came up in the newspaper yesterday about tick season. Because of the abundant rain and cool weather this winter and spring, there's a big, healthy crop of ticks out there just looking to put the bite on you. So especially if you sleep with your animals, your cats or your dogs, you want to think about using some anti-tick treatments on the animals, because you're likely to get bitten if the animal brings it in and you may not be aware of it. And there are lots of diseases, as you will learn next week, besides the dreaded Lyme disease, that are tick-borne and need to be thought of. So be sure you tune in next week. It's been a wonderful hour. I hope you've enjoyed it. So long. Stay healthy.